KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You can also hear the show at KCRW.com. You certainly know my guest, Sean Levy, because he's basically brought stunts into every comedy we know him for, from Cheaper by the Dozen to the Ninth Museum movies to his newest Date Night. Sean, first of all, thanks so much for being here.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
I want to ask you about that, though, because you use stunts in the way that action directors use action as a way to sort of embellish character, don't you?
Yeah, and I think that's kind of how life is, right? We reveal ourselves through the things we say, but we, frankly, more often perhaps reveal ourselves through the things we do and the way we move, the way we use our bodies. Ben Stiller, for instance, you always want to frame him in a medium shot or wider because his hands are part of his whole mojo.
You could say the same thing for Steve Martin almost.
You certainly would say Steve Martin. I would actually argue that you often want to be even wider.
Yeah,
you want to be head to toe.
Yes.
Because he's using torso, and I'm doing things right now that are wasted on radio, of course. listeners can trust that I'm acting all this out. So being aware of the way in which character is revealed, and sometimes it's through kind of physicality, sometimes through action stunts, as you say.
Walter Hill basically said in his movies that, you know, characters reveal themselves through physical action. And you're often testing your characters, your protagonists, through the action in the films.
That's absolutely true. My background is in theater. I went to Yale in the drama department. And I remember when I first started making short films in film school later at USC in the master's program, the teachers kept saying, Sean, you don't need to just show the whole person. You have a camera now. Get in on the face. You can get in on the face. It doesn't have to be presented in a kind of proscenium whole. But I think I've always thought of characters and the way you show them and reveal them as connected to their bodies and the things they do with their bodies. And so I think that now that I'm making these broader movies or these kind of larger scale movies, that stunts and action are connected to that somehow.
It's funny you say proscenium because you use a lot of master shots in comedy, which is kind of unusual.
Yes. It is a luxury, frankly, and nowhere more so than in this new movie, Date Night, to be able to shoot your actors in wider frames and more than one actor in the frame at the same time. And you know, Date Night, I didn't realize till I watched the movie back recently, there are more two shots in Date Night than certainly any movie I've done and than most movies I've seen. It's because so often in comedy or in film in general, you're creating performance, creating the rhythm of the joke, the rhythm of the scene through the montage, through the way in which you're editing. With Steve and Tina, they're so dialed in intuitively on their rhythms and on comedic rhythms and on being present in a scene, whether they're talking or not. Anyone who works in comedy knows that the difference between a laugh and no laugh is it's literally milliseconds. And if you have people like Carell and Faye or Ben Stiller and any number of the co-stars, I'm not going to say Ben and the Monkey in Ninth Museum, but it applies to them as well. But with Stiller in the Ninth Museum movies, we had co-stars like Ricky Gervais and Owen Wilson and Hank Azaria and Amy Adams and Robin Williams. So just, again, I like pairing strong performers so that they're able to find the rhythm together in real time in a real frame rather than creating it all.
You're clearly interested in that kind of physical tension of two people almost going to war with each other in the frame, aren't you?
Yeah. Coming towards each other, pulling apart from each other, and really telling stories of intimacy and distance within the frame. And it's the kind of thing where maybe 8 or 9 out of 10 viewers will see one of the movies I've done, and they'll just kind of go with it and they'll enjoy the ride, hopefully, and they're not going to think about that. But for those who do, it's present.
It feels almost like a throwback to me to like 30s screwball comedy in that way.
Well, when you don't have the luxury of technological advances or unending time to make a movie, I'm saying this is how kind of films used to be made under stringent circumstances where you had to get 7 pages of dialogue in a shot because then you had to do another 7 pages of dialogue after lunch. Having strong performers, though I don't have that time crunch, that time constraint to that extent, of course, I really do think that you get something magical, you get something special when you allow the chemistry to happen in a frame. I think that an audience is able to kind of enjoy it because they know it's not being created through an editorial rhythm. They're watching it being created between the performers.
It's The Treatment. I'm talking to director Sean Levy. His new film, his director, is Date Night. Because I just find myself thinking about not only those screwball comedy directors, but also Blake Edwards, who you sort of essay by doing a Pink Panther remake. I think at some point, the way he did that, the way there are sort of two forces at battle in the frame, must have had some kind of influence on you in some way or another.
Sure. And I think, like most people of my generation, I grew up watching those Blake Edwards movies. And you know, in truth, my Pink Panther was more connected to my allegiance and love of Steve Martin than any desire to reinvent a classic wheel. You know, my Pink Panther was really made with full respect towards Blake Edwards' films, but really, frankly, an exploration of what a Steve Martin Clouseau might look like.
But even in that context, so you still have, in a lot of the frame, it's Steve Martin and Kevin Kline kind of going toe-to-toe. So it gets back to that kind of dynamic of tension that we're talking
yes,
about.
Yes, and similarly, when Steve Martin and Jean Reno, when they realize that they're parting ways as friends and partners, that's in a two-shot frame. And again, there you're not telling a warring story. You're telling one of connection and loss. So I do like what happens when you are watching and exploring two bodies in the same space.
And also bodies that are kind of working very hard to fill that space too. I mean, and that's why you use those wider shots so often.
Yeah, it does put the onus on the performer. And what I learned from Steve Martin, since you brought up Blake Edwards and the Pink Panther movie, is you can only ask a performer to fill that frame with their performance when you have a strong comedic idea. I remember on the Pink Panther movie, Steve said, look, you can't just put me in a coat rack together and expect it to be funny. That would work, mind you, for several other comedic performers. But Steve really early in my career taught me the critical importance of the premise, of the idea. What is the idea of the scene? And building the idea in concert with the performer. Because what's going to be funny for Steve Martin in a frame, an idea that's going to give and bear fruit for him, is going to be very different than for Ben Stiller or for Steve Carell or for Tina Fey. So, again, just you pick up these lessons along the way. I learned a ton from Steve about really doing the cerebral thinking work before you ask an actor to fill up the frame and be loose.
Because first and foremost, people tend to forget he's a stage performer, somebody who, before the word was used, deconstructed comedy and used all those sort of conventions and expectations and thwarting those expectations in his comedy.
Yeah, no question. And as I look at my career to date, two films with Steve Martin, two with Ben Stiller, now Tina Fey and Steve Carell, what unmistakably links them all, though they're very different performances, they're all very, very, very intelligent thinking, deep thinking people. Their comedy, while intuitive, yes, is never accidental. It's really the result of thinking and challenging the material and making sure that there's a strong comedic premise for them to then do their thing.
Well, we're the what we call the bread and butter part of the show. You tell us what the movie's about.
The bread and butter. All right, let me serve it up. Date Night's about a married couple that love each other, not a marriage in crisis, nor are they newlyweds. They're in that kind of that middle section of an adult relationship where it's neither brand new and fireworks every day, but nor is it, you know, at risk of being lost. They have kids, they have jobs, and they frankly are struggling to find each other in the midst of the to-do list. And so they go on a date night every week. But on one such date night, they decide to do something a little bit differently. They come into Manhattan as opposed to going to their local tavern in Jersey. They get dressed a little nicer. They show up at a fancy shishi restaurant where everyone is younger and better looking than them. And of course, they can't get a table. So they take someone else's reservation. And from that one act, that one small transgression unravels this evening that becomes their worst nightmare. But ultimately, ends up reclaiming the dynamism in their relationship that Date Night was supposed to preserve in the first place.
But you say they're not in crisis, but at some point in all of your movies, there's kind of a crisis moment. There's something that kind of spurs people into acting or reacting in a certain way.
Yes, and
I don't want to give that away here. But
I think that really the crisis in most of my movies, yes, it's circumstantial. There are forces of evil or threats to the well-being of the protagonist. That's certainly the case in the Ninth Museum movies and in Date Night. But it's also about a kind of personal crisis of how do I want to live? In Ninth Museum 1, it's about a father wanting to reclaim the pride of his son. In Date Night, it's about, well, we can just kind of get by both in this night and in our marriage, or we can try and step up. We can try and surprise each other and ourselves, and in so doing, reconnect in a newly vibrant way. And that was really, though there are lots of laughs and car chases and lots of visual stuff, date night for me started and ends with an exploration of that relationship and of that reconnection.
It's The Treatment. I talked to director Sean Levy about his career to date, which also includes a new film, Date Night, which he directed. Also, too, though, in so many of these movies, even to some extent, it's an ad hoc family in Pink Panther. Family is key to you.
It is key to me. It is key to me. It's everywhere in all the movies. The brotherhood relationship between, as you say, Steve Martin and Jean Reno. I really do find myself continually coming back to stories about family in whatever way they are defined. And what I believe, which is frankly, and though this is maybe a kind of grandiose way of putting it, but the redemptive power of familial connection, the ability to be saved or to at least have your better self saved in our connection with the right people.
Where does that come from? I mean, because at some point you've got to realize it's a conscious thing, or has it always been a conscious thing for you?
It's never been a conscious thing. It's only now that I've made enough movies to look back and to actually, whether it exists or not, to certainly to see that connective tissue between movies. And you know what sparked it? It's the Date Night's the first non-family film. So a lot of people say, well, Date Night, is that a departure movie?
Strictly speaking, it's still about a family.
It's about a family very much so after the kids go to sleep. So to me, it's an organic outgrowth of what I've been doing. But to people who think of, oh, he's that Cheaper by the Dozen Night at the Museum guy, he makes movies for kids and families, I think that it's not a departure. It's very much continuous in exploring, as you say, these relationships that are critical in our emotional well-being. And I don't know. I certainly had an unconventional history with multiple divorces. And well, I won't self-psychoanalyze too much on your show.
That's why you're here.
Oh, really? I didn't know. It's an ambush. It's a psychoanalytic ambush. My parents got divorced when I was 3. There were remarriages on both sides. There were re-divorces on both sides. But what I ended up with is 5 siblings, steps and halves and some full blood and sisters and brothers. And it ended up being a very loud, chaotic amalgam of family in my adolescent years. And I loved it. I loved the bedlam of it. So certainly Cheaper by the Dozen was a love letter to the messy, loud chaos of a big family. And now that I've got my own family with three daughters and wife that I adore, I really do look at, frankly, family in the midst of a busy life. But it's really both kind of one's grounding, and it can be, again, big word, but for me, I found it to be true, salvation.
There is that thing that's both crisis point and kind of mundane at the same time. I mean, you're not looking for that big movie moment kind of thing, but actually the sort of thing that probably everybody can relate to, right?
Yes. Perhaps the best example I can give you of it is that in Date Night, I knew it was going to start with this married couple. I knew that it was going to explore some of the mundane realities of adult relational life. That said, even though there was going to be crazy car chases and action and comedy, I always knew that movie was going to end in a silent, quiet moment in a diner as the sun comes up over Manhattan. And I always knew that the last line of that movie was going to be a husband saying to his wife, I choose you every time. It's a moment that has happened in my life. It's certainly a feeling that I feel in my own life, and I think many of us do. But there's no witnesses. There's no grand applause. There's no big kind of hullabaloo. These moments of connection with the people who matter to us are very quiet and very private and incredibly, incredibly valuable.
We'll take a break. It's The Treatment. More psychoanalysis with my guest, Sean Levy's new film as a director, is Date Night. More to come. Stay tuned.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. More psychoanalysis with my guest, Sean Levy. His new film as director is Date Night. But you said Bedlam, and Bedlam is also key to the movies, too.
Yes.
I mean, that sort of that chaos.
Yes.
As a director, you create that, but also it's got to be controlled. I mean, you've got to know what the point of it is. So it's that weird contrast and seemingly contradictory thing, isn't it?
I do tend to be drawn to a certain messiness of life. And yet it's often related to either kids or family life. In this case, my new movie is about marriage, but it gets plenty messy. And yet those big chaos scenes are the hardest to do because you have to be safe. You have to be efficient. You want it to feel energetic and visceral and buoyant, but you don't want it to feel like a sludge of chaotic energy. And so you plan every bit of the action. You plan every bit of the production design. You tell every specific actor what you want them to do, even if you know that it's going to be 15 people all doing a specific bit of action. And that, yes, there's going to be a cacophony created out of it. But it's a very, I guess I'd have to call it an orchestrated cacophony.
You know, just going from Cheaper by a Dozen, these last six movies that you've done have all had these at some point some enormous scene with a bunch of people in it, and I wonder if the first time you did that it scared you at all, or if it still continues to scare you, because finally you've got to make each one of these things work.
You know, I've often said that if you are meant to be a director, if you've just got that in your bones, the first time you have a sequence that's loud and complicated and filled with a lot of people, you either get paralyzed by the daunting nature of it or you kind of love it. And ever since, frankly, even since my student film shorts, I've always loved being in that moment of, okay, I got 150 crew members, I got X number of performers, X number of background performers, what are we doing here? And you just don't pause after that. You just start figuring it out. And I'm a guy, I was this way even as a student in elementary school and certainly through college. I like knowing what the challenge is and then I figure it out. And so I don't give myself time to get that kind of paralyzing anxiety. But thanks for making me think about it.
Oh, no. You know, now that you're self-conscious, we'll see what the next movie's going to be
next
like.
Movie.
But you talk about your theater background at Yale. I wonder what kind of stuff you staged there when you were in school.
Well, I studied primarily 20th century American theater. And so, yes, it was a lot of Williams and O'Neill and Miller, but also a lot of Mamet and Sam Shepard. The defining moment for me, both at Yale and I think in what would become the evolution of my career, was in my senior year, I directed Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf by Edward Albee, starring Paul Giamatti. So I'm 20 years old. Okay, directing Giamatti, who at 20 is as searing a George as Richard freaking Burton. Okay, it was, you find anyone who was at Yale in the late 80s, I'd wager many of them remember Giamatti's performance because it was staggering that at 20 he played this completely broken-spirited, disillusioned middle-aged man. And what I remember about that production is A, really feeling the satisfaction of taking a talented performer like Paul and getting him to his best performance. That's in large part the job of a director, right? In fact, I would argue that there's someone else to help you edit it or light it or do the sound or compose the score, et cetera, et cetera. But the one aspect, the only aspect of a director's job that no one else can help you with, nor should they, is getting performance for and from your actors. And I really, really remember directing Paul and Virginia Woolf and thinking, this is really gratifying, is kind of just massaging and coercing and directing the performance to its best version of itself.
Wow, it's The Treatment. I'm talking to director Sean Levy, whose new film is Date Night, but worked again with Paul Giamatti in Big Fat Liar.
My first gig, my first studio movie. I remember I was doing, you know, Disney Channel television episodes, and they flew me out to LA and they said, okay, are you ready for this? And I said, hell yeah, come on. They said, who do you want to play the adult lead? And without blinking, I said, my college buddy, Paul Giamatti. And at that point, he had done Private Parts, the Howard Stern movie. He had done a few things, but this is 2000, I think.
Yeah, and this is the biggest part he ever had.
And
at that point,
it was certainly in the most commercial movie, you know, in the biggest part. And we all knew him, you know. But I remember saying to the brass at Universal at the time, I said, I'm telling you, this is one of the great actors of my generation, and he will crush this part. And indeed, he came in playing this ridiculous over-the-top movie producer named Marty Wolf, and it not only made the movie so much better, but it allowed me to make my first big studio movie with my college buddy.
It's funny, you talk about Mamet, and there's so much comedy and melodrama in Mamet simultaneously, and to some extent, even in Virginia Woolf. All these playwrights you mentioned, there's an element of the absurdist to them, even in the drama, and that certainly is a part of the way you make these comedies as well.
Yeah, there's an exploration of, well, really does, you know, we're kind of trying to put our characters in a forced circumstance, in an extremely kind of over-ratcheted tension. And sometimes that will skew towards the absurd or the surreal. And, you know, I remember Peter Bart, who writes for Daily Variety, he wrote about this Night at the Museum, the second one at the Smithsonian, is almost kind of like Ionesco-like surrealism, which, you know, might be a lofty attribution. But yeah, I guess that there is an absurdist quality. I have to share a Mamet anecdote if we can. I had the great good fortune of sharing a meal with him, and it was thrilling for me because I'm a huge fan of his. And I said, "Mr. Mamet, of all the awards and the success, which one means the most?" And he said, "It's sitting in a theater with the lights down and my show's up on the stage and you have 300-400 strangers laughing. And it's like a wave. And they're not faking that. They're not out to get you, nor are they out to make you feel good. They're just a bunch of strangers in a dark room laughing at something collectively because it strikes them as amusing." And it's something that was so, it stayed with me because, of course, that's what I do for a living. And at the end of the day, beyond reviews, beyond analysis, what happens in that dark room is the most pure reaction you're going to get to your work.
To hear you talk about this now, I mean, this kind of superstructure that's so much integral to what you do, at what point do you throw it away? I mean, because it's got to be almost subliminal.
I guess I throw it away when I start shooting the movie in this regard. I spend a year, and this is certainly on the last three movies, I spend a year working on the screenplay, honing that script. And that process becomes working on the script with the writers, bringing it to my actors, getting their input, their feedback, going back with the writers, rewriting it, bringing it back to the actors, getting more feedback, suggestions, hearing them read it out loud, going back to the writers. So literally this shuttling process for almost a year means that when you start shooting, you have a script vetted by and fully kind of channeling your actors already. What that gives you is the ability then to let go a bit. You know you have a strong script, so when you start shooting, you can let scenes find themselves. You can see blocking take shape in front of you without telling the actors, you sit in that chair and on that line, you cross to the door. You allow them to show you what happens organically. And similarly, and maybe most importantly, in comedy, you have the freedom to let improvisation happen.
It's the treatment. I talked to director Sean Levy. His new film, his director, is Date Night. But I would say in all the movies, there are moments that almost veer towards the melodramatic, though.
Yes. If by melodramatic you mean unabashedly emotional, yes. And frankly, for a period in my career early on, I was self-conscious about that because it would be pointed out that, well, the movies are funny, yeah, but they've got this very soft, warm-heartedness. And now, 6-7 movies into my career, I'm just not able to turn that off. I live emotionally. I make the movies emotionally. I want them to be funny, but I want them to be more than funny. Whether it's melodramatic or poignant or cheesy or sweet, I do see a very consistent trait in the things that I make, and they do tend to have a moment or a few that are ultimately about, honestly, connection and family and are able to present those moments in unironic, uncynical ways.
But it's interesting because I almost wonder how much of you realizes at some point these movies are part of this sort of working autobiography of yours in which things are not stated but present.
I can honestly tell you, Elvis, that I don't know that I had realized it till I came on your show. So I want to thank you. No, in all seriousness, because partly because I make the movies back to back and I work at a pretty intense pace, I've not allowed myself nor been allowed much time for self-reflection, to sit back and look at it.
But as you, because you've talked about this before, just a few minutes ago, as a matter of fact, how intensely sort of driven and thoughtful and precise all these actors are. So at some point, your lives have to come up in conversation about these movies, don't they?
Every time. I think it's such an interesting thing that most people don't know is that when you make these movies, and especially when you make a movie like Date Night, when you sit, when Steve and Tina and I would sit and have dinner and talk about the script, we weren't talking about the script. We were telling our stories. We were telling the story of, hey, you know what happens with my marriage? Hey, you know what my husband does? I'll tell you what my wife said. And round she goes. We end up talking about our lives, and it does get confessional. It does get, frankly, honest. And you pool those experiences. Certainly I did on Date Night. I pooled our stories. I pooled our experiences. I took comfort in seeing the strands of common theme. And a lot of it ended up in the movie that became Date Night.
Well, because just knowing a bit about you and your background, I would figure that a natural for you at some point would be to turn to the work of Mordecai Richler.
Well, as a Jew from Montreal, Richler, he's in the pantheon of Jews from Montreal. So it's almost like it's not quite required reading in the Quebec public school system, but it kind of is required reading in a Jewish home in Montreal, Quebec.
All these things we're talking about, identity at some point is key. All these things we talked about is all in Richler, and I just wondered if you're somebody who you'd ever turn to or thought about bringing to the screen in some way.
I haven't thus far. The only experience that I'm trying to bring to the screen as far as bringing prose to film adaptation is by my friend Steve Martin, who wrote a beautiful book called The Pleasure of My Company a few years back. And Jonathan Tropper, the novelist, is adapting that for me. He wrote that fantastic book, This Is Where I Leave You. But I do find that having made these big movies, big in scope, big in budget, big in physicality, it's given me the freedom to say, well, you know what? There's these other stories I want to tell too, whether it's Pleasure of My Company or the movie I'm making now with Hugh Jackman called Real Steel, which is really a father-son drama. I feel like, and maybe it's all connected to having turned 40 last year, I'm definitely in my exploratory, let me try my hand at a few things. And yes, indeed, we may find that there's common traits in all. They may all be kind of unabashedly populist and warm-hearted, but they won't all necessarily be comedies, and that's exciting.
I have to say this, though, because you said populist, and you paused before you said that. Do you get a hard time about that from
Hell
some
yeah.
People?
Is that okay to say on this show, hell yeah?
Yes, I'm just public radio. Hell all you want.
All
go
right.
Ahead.
Love it. Love it. Yes, and yes, and yes, because the bottom line is when you do what I do for a living, which is, yes, making populist, crowd-pleasy movies, you're not going to get the same – certainly you'd never have the same relationship with the critical community because you're making movies for, frankly, a different crowd and with a different kind of aspiration. And I think I still wrestle with this ambivalent relationship to populism because it is what comes naturally to me. It is, frankly, the kind of movie that I love, and yet – it's almost, I guess, maybe in some quarters considered a bit of a dirty word. So you once again psychoanalyzed me quite successfully, Mr. Mitchell. The pause before the word populism. That will be certainly, if ever I write a confessional essay for The New Yorker, it will be titled The Pause Before Populism.
Well, I think we opened enough cans of worms for today. Sean, thanks so much for doing this.
This was a pleasure. Thank you.
My guest is Sean Levy. His new film as director is Date Night. Our recording engineer at Carnegie Studios in New York is Lesha Voracek. Bob Carlson is the editor. Joe Dempsey is the producer. We're sitting on the couch. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about The Treatment, please email us at thetreatment@kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.